We have a repeat guest. He was with us some time before, and we knew the eclipse was coming up, and so we invited him back. Dave Reeves, west of Nashville, you have a Museum of Wonders. Give me the exact name of your facility.
Yeah, good morning, Keith and Kathy. It's the Wonders Center and Science Museum. It's in Dixon, Tennessee, about 35 minutes west of downtown Nashville.
Very good, which means we'll get to it before Nashville if you're coming from Branson. So are you right off of 40? Or?
Yeah, we're right off of 40, about a mile and a half, 2 miles off of 40.
Good. Give me the website where we can find out a lot more about it before we dig into today's subject.
So the website is wonderscenter.org. That's wonderscenter.org. And you can find out a whole lot more about the museum as well as sign up. We put together a free magazine that we send out once every other month. And all of the details are right there on that website.
All right. Very good. We talked the last time you were here, and you kind of told us about how all this got started for you. But let's recap for those folks that didn't hear your last appearance on Good Morning Ozarks.
Well, you know, when I was about 16 years old, Keith, I actually started taking photographs of space as a hobby. And so I would take a telescope, and then I would take a DSLR camera and try to connect the camera to the back of the telescope. And I was trying to take photos of galaxies, nebulae, things like that. Well, a nebula is a cloud in space. In Latin, nebula means cloud. So I started to take a photo of the Great Orion Nebula at 16. And it's extremely challenging. There's an artwork to it because you have to have the perfect conditions. Everything has to be 100% in focus. Everything has to be, there can be no, we call it seeing in the atmosphere. So there has to be low water vapor, low dust levels. Everything has to align. But it did. And I got a picture of this Great Orion Nebula, and my jaw hit the floor. I could not believe what I was seeing, and it was just as beautiful as incredibly colorful and well-designed as I'd always seen from the pictures in Science Telescope magazine or Hubble Space Photography. And I was faced with a pivotal moment at that point, and I said, "How do I keep this to myself as a hobby, or do I actually share this with not just friends and family, but with the world?" And so at 18, I formed a nonprofit with my brother, who's a year older, and I began speaking on astronomy and the Bible, how the heavens declare the glory of God. I haven't stopped since.
Amen. As I was growing up in school in Los Angeles, I was in a non-Christian home, and we would take field trips to the Griffith Park Observatory, which I don't know if you've been to or not, but at least you know about it, I'm sure. And I was amazed with the size of space. They never said, well, you go out so far and you'll reach a wall. And, you know, how did it all get? And they were a little bit less Big Bang Theory in those days. They kind of left it open a little bit, but I don't suppose they do now. But I came out of there just amazed, and I didn't know what happened. But that just didn't – it just rang in my spirit at that time that somebody was in charge of all of this.
Well, absolutely. That's the impression that almost everyone gets until they're told otherwise. And the problem is that almost everyone in schools, universities, are taught otherwise, and they're taught otherwise at an early age. Even if you're watching a kids program on astronomy, you're likely going to hear the phrase, oh, you are star stuff, the result of 14 billion years of chance. Well, what does that do to our self-worth? What does that do to the idea that how we perceive ourselves is going to affect society? So all of a sudden, there's been a pivot from the idea that we're wonderfully made with purpose to this idea that we are nothing more than a cosmic accident. But, Keith, you know, the first time I was in L.A., I said, yeah, I've got to make it to the Griffith Observatory. And every time I'm in Southern California, I go out there. And I look at the beautiful, they've got some solar scopes, they've got some other telescopes, and great information. And probably my favorite thing, they've got a very large Tesla coil invented by Nikola Tesla, which has played a part. It actually influenced me when I was building out this museum in Nashville, because I wanted to be able to allow people to experience the genius of Nikola Tesla. And maybe in a bit we can get into a story if you remind me, but I'd love to tell you the story about how we were able to obtain a Tesla coil that was basically influenced by Griffith Observatory.
That would be cool, and I'm sure that came long after I was there. I don't remember anything like that, but it was a fascinating place for a young guy in school.
You know, I'm a little country girl, and my experience in my early life was we'd get to sleep out on the lawn at the farm, and I would lay there in the dark looking at the stars, and it was unbelievable because they were clear. There was no light pollution in those days, and it was it was breathtaking. And as a kid, I don't know, I think somehow I always knew there was a God. I don't know why, but of course I didn't get all the stuff in school that the kids are getting now either. Country school was different, and even the little town schools that I went to.
Well, Kathy, that's the thing. Almost everyone looking up there says there must be a God. You probably saw the Milky Way. You probably saw several thousand stars if you were in a very dark area out in the country. And that's what everyone comes away with when they look up at the night sky is, whoa, we must have a big God. But when we're brainwashed from an early age, then all of a sudden these last few generations are coming away saying, well, I must suppress what I naturally know. I have to put aside the idea that it seems obvious that there's a God, and I must go with what my teachers and what my professors are telling me is scientific fact. But Romans 1 says all you have to do is look around at creation, and it's evident there is a creator. God himself is made evident through the things that he's put out in the world for us to find.
Amen. That's for sure. Well, let's talk about yesterday. Everybody has been talking about it for months, and it culminated in about 4 minutes of total eclipse.
Totality.
Totality in some places. Came in from Mexico up through Texas, Arkansas, on up through Illinois, and just up in the Maine area, and then up to Canada. Where did you happen to catch it?
All right, well, that's an amazing story, because the day before the eclipse, I was in Dallas, Texas. I had flown out to Dallas to speak with two NASA astronauts, one being the youngest man to ever walk on the moon. And we had been speaking at a conference with about 800 people. The eclipse did go right through the Dallas area, and so I had resolved myself to watch from Dallas, or watch from Texas. I had actually picked out about three different locations all over Texas, just in case one area was cloudy and the other area was clear. So after I got through speaking with these astronauts and several other colleagues and friends of mine, I said, well, where am I going to head? Well, it didn't look good at all anywhere in Texas at the time. Mm-hmm. And you can't trust the weather, but I booked a flight to Memphis. And I said, well, I'm going to go to Memphis, and then I'm going to head out somewhere. I don't know where. Well, all of a sudden, Indianapolis began looking clear, and so I said, well, I guess it's going to be Indianapolis. So, changed the flight to Nashville. I flew into Nashville the night before the eclipse, got in at about 8 p.m., and jumped in a car, began driving, and Indianapolis started not looking the greatest.
Oh, no.
Here I go. I'm up, actually, in, guess where? Cape Girardeau.
I was going to say Missouri.
So I ended up closer to your neck of the woods and settled down in Cape Girardeau, Jackson area, and got a hotel, settled in for the night. the next morning, I was on Newsmax at 6:30 a.m., and then I stepped outside, and there was not a cloud in the sky. I talked to the hotel manager, said, can I set up in the parking lot? They said, yeah, absolutely. So we had all of these people who were just flocking over to see our equipment and talk with me about the eclipse. Had no idea, had never met any one of them, but it was the most amazing experience.
How did you find a motel room in Cape Girardeau that quick, close to the close to the event? My goodness. The Lord was with you, I guarantee you, Dan.
The Lord was with me because it was the only hotel room. There was one hotel room left in the entire region. Wow. And there were two at around 9 or 10 p.m. the night before the eclipse. I tried to grab one, and it disappeared. Someone had snatched it up before I could get it. And so there was one hotel room left in the entire region, and I grabbed it just in time.
Well, you...
God saved it for
that's
you.
That's exactly right. You were supposed to be
right.
Where you were. You said setting up equipment in the parking lot yesterday here in Branson, where we saw about 97 or 8, people have said... as it got really close, people started coming, went out in our little shopping center area where our printing company is located, and gathering around and looking at through the glasses. And one guy had a welder's helmet, and he kind of looked through that. Kathy and I made a little box where you got a hole at one end and paper at the other.
Yep.
And, you know, that was kind of a crude way to do it, but it worked, and she was able to see some darkness start happening across it. But what kind of equipment did you set up in their parking lot?
Okay, so I do take astrophotography seriously, and I had a triplet apochromatic refractor, which is known to be one of the most precise refractor telescopes. It was about 102 millimeter, and I put that on a mount and on a tripod. Then I set up another tripod with a very powerful, about a 600 millimeter telephoto lens with a camera, then another camera for video, then I had another camera to capture the experience of the eclipse in 360 footage and full world footage, and then a few more pieces of technology as well.
Good.
Nice. So it was quite the setup.
I bet.
Then I tinned down a white sheet with four rocks, and right in the middle of the parking lot, because there's an effect called shadow banding that you can see in the 2 minutes prior to totality. All of a sudden, there's this an effect called shadow banding that makes it look like there are ripples of shadows flashing across the sheet. And it's not even very understood. It has to do with the refraction of that tiny sliver of the sun hitting the atmosphere, and it breaks up into different waves, but it literally makes this sheet look like it is flashing and cloudy, and that happens about 2 minutes before totality.
Did you get pictures of it?
I did get pictures of it. I'm still going through all of my footage. I had to, it's been a long few days, so I finally had to call it a night last night, but I was able to photograph it.
Now, will you be putting that up on your website?
Yes, I may not put it up on the website itself, but in about 2 days' time, if you subscribe to our email updates right off of that website, there's a thing that says subscribe to our emails and magazine or something like that. Just put your email address down, put your address down, and in about 2 days' time, I'll send out an email with all of the pictures.
Oh,
and
exciting.
When I say all of the pictures, we got... we were able to get solar prominences, fire shooting off of the sun during totality, where you can see these massive red loops flashing off of the sun.
Oh,
we were able to get, it looks like we were able to get Bailey's beads, where you can actually see the craters, the lunar craters and mountains with the sun shining across them, and that's a very rare event,
yeah.
And so much more. So we'll be... not posting those on wonderscenter.org, but we will be emailing those to everyone who goes to Wonders Center and signs up.
Now, you say that the rare event of the craters we're having on the moon, You don't see that in any or every one of the totality situations?
No, you do not. Those are something that you actually have to photograph. There's not really an opportunity for you to see them with your naked eye. But if you photograph it and you photograph during the last few nanoseconds right before totality, that's the only opportunity you have to capture Bailey's beads.
Wow. So you're basically just shooting maybe automatically or whatever, bam, 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 right?
Yeah, we're actually shooting a bracketed system. So in photography, bracketing is where when I press the shutter release button, it actually takes three pictures, not simultaneously, but three pictures in fairly quick succession, and it takes each picture at a slightly different exposure. Because what you have to remember is during totality, you've got 4 minutes here, and you're so excited that you're having trouble focusing on all of the camera settings. So you may miss the perfect spot or the perfect exposure during that brief 4 minute window. And that's where I'll set up an automation where if I got my brightness settings, my exposure settings slightly off in the chaos and confusion and the excitement of the eclipse, that the camera itself will try to compensate by making one picture slightly darker, one picture slightly brighter, and that way at least one of the three is going to be decent. And then I still have to, all the way through the eclipse, manually press that shutter. It's just that every time I press it, there are multiple pictures being taken.
That is awesome. Now, I heard somebody say that there are three sections of the sun. The one that we always see, which is the brightest, they called something. And then there's two, I guess it would only be visible if that center very brightness was covered by the moon. Do you know what he's talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we typically see of the sun is basically the sun's surface, and that's about 12,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is extremely hot. Now, we can use a solar filter and our even solar glasses, like so many people had, and we can look up there and occasionally see sunspots on the sun. And those sunspots are cool spots, which are only 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So we went from 12,000 to 6,000 degrees, but that's still pretty toasty.
Yeah.
And then during totality is this brief window of time where you can actually see the surface of the sun. You can see solar prominences, which is basically the fire that shoots off of the sun. But that really is only possible when the center of the sun is covered up and you're only seeing the very outer edges. And the reason that's interesting is because our sun is about 93 million miles away. And it's so much larger than the moon, but the moon is 400 times closer, 400 times smaller, so it perfectly covers that extremely bright center of the sun while still exposing right around the edges. And that's the only way that it is really capable for any common person to be able to capture the surface of the sun and to capture those solar prominences. So that's the one out of the three that is extremely rare. And then the third out of the three that, again, you really can only capture during a total solar eclipse is called the corona, and corona means crown. So during a solar eclipse, you see it with your naked eye, and you can take a photo of it, but the corona or the crown, it appears that the sun is wearing this looped crown all the way around it, and that's the magnetic activity surrounding the sun, and it's extremely hot. I'm talking about the surface of the sun is 12,000 Fahrenheit. Well, we're talking in the millions Fahrenheit with this corona way out beyond the sun. And I'll just tell you, you know, this is something that I don't think it could happen by chance. No. I mean, I don't know about you, Keith and Kathy, but to me, this appears finely tuned. This appears extremely well engineered, and to have something that is designed or engineered requires a designer or an engineer. And I know who that grand designer is. I know who the master engineer is, and it's the God of the Bible,
amen.
Ultimately Jesus.
Amen. Amen and amen. That's kind of what your facility talks about, is how it's all put together and by whom, right?
It is. In the Wonder Center, we have, as you walk in the rotunda, you're greeted with a 55-foot-long Camarasaurus, a long-neck sauropod dinosaur. So that's what you see as you get your tickets. He's stretching his neck up into the second story of the building. We've actually got dinosaur bones that children can touch from that dinosaur found in Utah. Then after you get tickets, you start your way through the museum. It's a massive, largest science museum in Tennessee at over 100,000 square feet. But as you're walking through, you'll see exhibit halls dedicated to different scientific fields, whether it's astronomy, with meteorites that you can actually touch, pieces of rock that fell from space, large telescopes. Then you might wander into another exhibit hall called the Wonders of Paleontology, where you'll see massive rocks, fossils, living fossils, fast fossils, full-size dinosaur models, all sorts of things. And then you wander a bit further, and you'll happen into another exhibit hall that we call the Wonders of Zoology, where you meet live animals, a little gecko, and we talk about the design behind the gecko's foot and how we've even patterned our Velcro off of a gecko's foot, off of this whole idea of a hook and loop system, that we design suction cups, that we design all these things trying to mimic what a gecko can do, and we still don't do that with near the effectiveness. And then we've got tons of kids' hands-on activities. You can, there's a dinosaur sand pit. You can do downhill racing experiments to see which, what kind of mass and gravity reaches the bottom of the track the fastest. You can experiment with gear ratios. We have an augmented reality virtual sand pit that you can push sand around and create mountains and craters and lakes with fish swimming in them, and it's quite an experience.
Sounds fun.
It sounds amazing. In fact, I think that one of the things you ought to do is get AOC a gift card to come and visit, because she thinks that she can take a trip to the sun.
Yeah, and I think she should.
Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get her a free ticket for the Heavens Declare the Glory of God, the Heavens Declare Planetarium that we have here. It's a massive 60-foot full-dome planetarium, and we can virtually take her to the sun.
I think that's fabulous.
You talked about the Tesla coil, and we want to hit that before we get through with visiting with you this morning. So give me that information about what that is and how'd you end up with one.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, Keith. When I'm out in L.A., I typically try to stop by the Griffith Observatory. I've always have. And in the Griffith Observatory, they have one room in there that they've kind of blocked off. They've blasted in. And they put a Tesla coil in there, which was an invention of Nikola Tesla in 1891. It shoots electricity, you know, maybe once an hour or so, and so you can watch this electricity coming off of this Tesla coil. Well, I have a friend who was visiting the Wonder Center before we opened. We're a brand new museum. We just opened a few months ago, and a friend was visiting. He was standing in the rotunda, and he was in awe. He is involved. He has an amazing testimony, but he was involved with a rock band that frequently visited L.A. and that had the namesake of Nikola Tesla, the inventor. And so I said, you know, every time I'm out in L.A., I always visit the Griffith Observatory and see the Tesla coil because I love the inventions of Nikola Tesla. It would be neat to have one of those someday in the museum. To which my friend replies, oh, you want one of those? He pulls his phone out of his pocket right then and there, FaceTimes a buddy of his, and said, "Do you think you could hook my buddy David up with a Tesla coil for the museum?" And his friend said, "Let me see what I can do." So we were donated two massive 5-foot-tall musical Tesla coils. They produce 1,000,000 volts of electricity. I'm talking about 6-foot bolts of lightning. We put visitors to the museum in the same room with this lightning, and we play these coils at shows throughout the day. And the coils pulse. The electricity pulses at a certain rate, and that pulse varies. So you believe that you're hearing music from that lightning, even though there are no speakers attached.
My goodness. That's something I don't think I want to touch.
I have already put you on my bucket list.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. David, this is fascinating. Incredible. And I quoted you yesterday because we had, like I said, 97%, 98%. I said we had David Reeves on the air the other day, and he said that there is a huge difference between 98 and 100. And I imagine that you found 100 in Cape Girardeau, and what an awesome sight and what a fun time it was.
Yes, sir. Well, I cannot wait to have you both to the Wonder Center and Science Museum. You're not that far away. You're just a few hours down the road, and it's great for couples, families, everything. Can't wait to see you.
Give me the website one more time.
WondersCenter.org.
All right, go there and sign up for that newsletter and for the email. Get some photos of the 100% totality in Cape Girardeau that Dave took some pictures. Dave, we look forward to having you back again, all right, my friend?
Yes, sir. Looking forward to it.
All right, God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dave.
God bless.